This is Fanboy versus Transformers with Chris, Rob Clay, Brickinator, and Matt.
All right, this is Fanboy versus Transformers, and this week is Fanboy versus Transformers Windblade number one. So we're second issue into the Combiner Wars, and, well, hey, at least it's going better than Dark Cybertron.
Yeah.
Vaguely.
So far.
Fingers crossed.
Admittedly, that's not much of a thing to compare it against, but, you know. Hopefully, you know, after all this is over, it'll be a long time before we have to compare anything else to these.
Yeah.
Like, that's my ambition for this anyway. Let this be the last crossover for a while, because let's let things just do what they do.
Yeah.
So, of course, joining me this week, I have Rob Clay.
Hi.
Matt, or Melvar.
I'm sorry.
Wait, what are you sorry for?
Just in general.
Oh, okay. And we have Brickinator, or Mark.
I'm also sorry, but, you know, as a Canadian, that's default.
Plus, you have that charming accent, so...
Oh, yeah. a boot and a boot by, something like that. see, we have our own accent here in Newfoundland that Canadians make fun of, so don't even get me started.
I know. I have another friend who used to live there who told me that there's a comedian whose whole routine is based around that fact.
Yeah, and I'm sure it would just be gibberish to an outsider.
Well, he gave us an example of it once on another recording I was doing, and yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I followed it, but I'm amazing like that.
It's true.
All right, so let's get into this this issue of Windblade. So, on the colony of Kaminus, an odd range of disturbances are detected, and a security detail is dispatched to investigate. Swindle is somewhere on the colony cursing Starscream as he's found nothing on this colony to steal like he had been promised. Afterburner, or maybe Snipe, I don't know, that he's not actually named in this, and his Alpha Squadron arrive and attempt to arrest Swindle, who laughs in their face as Menasor appears. Afterburner tries to carry out his job, but he gets stomped on for his trouble. Menasor begins a rampage, and as Swindle tries to settle him down, he realizes Starscream has set them all up. Swindle pleads with the Stunticons to separate so they can retreat quietly, but it's no good. On Cybertron, Optimus places an emergency call to Starscream, summoning him to the Space Bridge chamber. Filled in on the unauthorized use of the Space Bridge, Starscream orders his own troop to pursue Swindle and the Stunticons and help save a world today. But as they emerge from the portal, they're quickly swatted aside by Menasor, along with the Kamian defense forces. Chromie and Ironhide have gone as well and try to support from the ground, but they have no better effect. Windblade insists on joining the defense of her world, and Optimus volunteers to join her, but Windblade makes him stay behind. Arriving in time to break Chromia's fall after being dropped from Minasaur's grasp, Windblade sees the situation is completely beyond them and calls back to Cybertron for more backup. Optimus demands Starscream dispatch the aerial bots. Starscream is unwilling, but Optimus is able to intimidate him into compliance. The aerial bots fly through the bridge and combine, and Superion orders Minasaur to surrender. It's clear that Superion's intelligence is greater than Minasaur, and as the fight between them proceeds, Superion is able to act quicker and with better tactics, such as leveraging his modular body structure to let a punch pass through his body. A shot to Minasaur's head knocks him down, but shows little lasting effect, but it's enough opening for Superion to beat the Stunticon Combiner into submission. Windblade then asks after the well-being of the aerial bots, and Superion assures her he's fine, but maybe he should have been called in a little sooner as he surveys the damage done in the vicinity of the space bridge. Windblade speaks to one of her people and requests an audience with the colony's bodies of authority. Windblade directs that Menasor should be disassembled with Superion's help and his components sent back to Cybertron, but Windblade warns that no one should go near the space bridge itself. However, the Parliament insists Starscream be brought to Kaminus because Cybertron is responsible for the incident, and Cybertron must make it right. Finally, Windblade meets privately with the Mistress of Flame before returning to Cybertron. Starscream's only too happy to meet the leaders of Kaminus, especially when they're not interested in speaking to Optimus Prime. However, someone else does want to meet Optimus. Windblade explains that to her people, the Primes are deified. As a living Prime, holder of the Matrix, Optimus will be seen in the same way. Windblade knows that if he's unopposed, Starscream will Starscream his way to effective rule of Kaminus. It might help both worlds in the short term, but Windblade thinks with Optimus' help, more good can be done, and so she presents him with the choice. On Kaminus, Starscream speaks with the Parliament, who are only too pleased to be in the presence of Cybertron's leader. But Windblade emerges through the space bridge and announces the arrival of Optimus, the Living Prime. And upon sight of the Matrix within him, the Mistress of Flame welcomes him, and all others present follow. So, I think Rob brought up a good point about this in our show notes a little while ago. Optimus is basically agreeing to stand as kind of a religious figure for these people for the purpose of stopping Starscream from gaining control, and I'm not sure how that's really going to... I'm not sure what effect it's going to have on things, like, in the long term for this.
It's going to annoy the hell out of Starscream, just for one.
What doesn't annoy the hell out of Starscream that isn't Starscream's idea?
This is true.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought this is probably the most interesting character development we've gotten for Optimus Prime in basically forever. Because, you know, I think in terms of how Optimus Prime has been written in comics, both in IDW and Marvel, Megatron summed it up near the end of Dark Cybertron perfectly, saying, "No one wants to hear about your latest midlife crisis." And, you know,
that was one of the highlights of the end of Dark Cybertron, because the writing got so much stronger and you got stuff like that out of it. So go ahead and finish.
Yeah. But, you know, clearly, having been in a stalemate of war for 4 million years, Optimus Prime is capable of making some bad choices and choices that, you know, he may not think are entirely on the up and up if it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to me, and I actually find myself liking that we are seeing, you know, glimpses of the Optimus Prime that would employ Prowl in the first place.
Yes. Although, to the Prowl point, I kind of think it's a matter of he employed Prowl a long time ago before Prowl was so Prowl and before he realized Prowl was that Prowl.
That is also a point, but he's not stupid. He has to have figured out how Prowl is, and as long as Prowl manages not to Prowl directly in his face, he's been okay with it.
Well, Prowl was also Prowling for Sentinel Prime, wasn't he?
Can't remember.
Prowl was on the Cybertron security forces before Optimus, you know, Optimus.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Prowl has been Prowling for a while. He was already, you know, integrated. He already had his spot, and Optimus just never really replaced him, I don't think, for some reason.
Because if you think back to Shadow Play, you know, Prowl and Chrome Dome were doing the police thing when Orion Pax was still Orion Pax Super Cop.
Yeah.
So Prowl's been in that line of work since before the Optimus regime.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a good point. You know, he did have to know some of what Prowl was Prowling like back then, but it still never seemed quite so bad until the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, he is getting worse, and, you know, there's a story to tell there, too, if we ever get back there. Mm-hmm. But which I think ultimately we will, but this comes first.
And I think what Optimus is doing now in this has potential. Just because, you know, he's taking this really gray road right now, and there's going to have to be some consequence to the choice he's made a little later on. And so long as we actually get to see that consequence happen, you know, this could turn out really interesting, but it could also just be, like, kind of hand-waved away, like, he did the right thing, so nothing bad's going to happen as a result.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, with the writers we have, I think they'll do better than that. I sure hope so.
Well, I think this is interesting because in the last issue, the Transformers 39, Starscream and Optimus had this conversation about what happened when people followed a title instead of a leader. And, you know, we're falling right back into that. You know, everybody's just going to line up for religious reasons after Optimus because he has Prime in his name.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that, too. Like, there is definitely a parallel to that. And I know that's on purpose because Margaret Scott and John Barber plotted out the story together. So they're both working from the same playbook here. And there's definitely going to be something from that moving forward.
It's just going to be really weird if we have this whole big story arc that the point of which ends up being Starscream is right.
Right, but I love that we're in a place with these books that we can have that.
Yes.
Yes.
And the thing is, since Starscream took control of Cybertron, Starscream has been right a lot of the time.
Yeah.
He's being very Starscream about it, which is, he's not taking the best route to get to being right, but he is being right. It's kind of like, to use a Gundam analogy, remember how Amuro Ray always said everybody was out to get him? And there's always these conspiracies? And there were.
Yes.
He was right. He's just, he sounds too paranoid for anybody to take it credibly.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing here. Starscream is taking all the wrong roads, but he's going to the ends of being right. And yeah. It's a really interesting way to take that character. I really like that. It's one of the things I like about what used to be Robots in Disguise. It's one of the few things that's carried forward from what it originally was. Mark, did you have anything to add on this?
I'm just thinking it's good to give Optimus a purpose. So much of IDW Optimus has been Optimus without a cause. Like, he gave up the title of Prime, or he gave up leadership to Bumblebee, or, you know, he just feels useless. This could be a purpose for him, even if it's just walking the line.
And it seems to go back to the thing Rob referenced. It's his latest midlife crisis.
Well, yeah.
Because he doesn't have... I think Optimus does not have a direction to his life anymore, and he doesn't know how to deal with that.
I'm interested to see what the Chameleons think when they realize that, okay, he might have the Matrix, but he doesn't have the whole Matrix.
Yeah, there's nothing in there.
Yeah, although it seems to still glow pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all that matters.
Well, you know, there's backlighting in there, big LED.
Yeah.
I don't look directly at the LED. I made that mistake and I had purple spots in front of my eyes for hours.
I've done that.
Okay, so going back to the top of the issue, let's go over the points kind of in order here. So Menasor is fighting off the Kamian Defense Forces, and there's flashback panels intercut where Starscream is talking to Blackjack. I couldn't quite follow what the intent of this was exactly, and nothing in the issue really, like, lays out why that's there.
Starscream was talking to Blackjack about, you know, being a security forcer, but also having a temper problem, a temper control problem. Mm-hmm. And they put these scenes in between Swindle trying to talk Menasor down, trying to get him to stop his attack and leave, or break up and leave. And Menasor just was furious and couldn't. Just his temper was out of control. I think that's where Blackjack comes in.
Do you think Starscream introduced Blackjack into the Combiner to make him uncontrollable?
Absolutely. That would give, you know, more credence to Starscream being able to make his own army of Combiners to stop against, or to stand against ones that can't be controlled, like Menasor.
Mm-hmm. It would also probably explain why Superion seemed comparatively much more intelligent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because there's not one rogue element in there screwing everything up. They're more unified in purpose, like the Constructicons have been.
Even though I didn't see Power Glide in there anywhere.
He was the gun.
So even the comics think that the chestplate Transformers don't work very well.
Well, Power Glide's the gun in the toys, too.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Oh, for Blackjack, right.
Yes.
I think it was also just to give Blackjack a story. You know, we keep seeing Alpha Bravo being referenced. Power Glide was introduced. Off-Road's not really gotten anything, but, you know, it's more so just, hey, here's a newcomer. Let's give him a purpose as well. Whereas you couldn't really have made, you know, Dragstrip or someone necessarily betray them or be it your inside guy.
And also, like, Off-Road got a name drop last issue. Blackjack was there, but didn't get referenced specifically, so this is, like, his time to get a little intro. You know, Off-Road's kind of gotten the short end of the stick as far as that goes, because all he did was get his name drop in, like, a bubble of dialogue, which could have been assigned to basically anybody.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he will get more chance to be a character in subsequent issues, but for right now, he's just kind of existing.
Yeah.
So one thing I really liked was when Optimus calls Starscream in his office and Starscream's feigned concern. Like, that whole sequence is just really fantastic. It reminds me of...
Yeah, their interactions are just excellent. Well, because Starscream has the authority and Optimus is used to it, and so they just play it back and forth. It's really good.
The other thing, too, is it takes me back to the first Windblade miniseries, and Starscream was written this way through that. This is how Margaret Scott interprets this Starscream, and I really like this nuance on Starscream, because it takes some of what the IDW one had, it takes some of Transformers Prime Starscream, which is probably my favorite Starscream in general. You know, it takes a lot of Starscream elements and fuses them together into something that really, it comes into its own as a result of it. And you can see that just in this one little sequence, too. And of course, he's still planning for his future upgrade. I think now, having settled on the body, he's trying to pick new colors.
Yeah.
But why would
that
Starscream
was pretty good.
Colors?
Well, he changed Armada colors.
Yeah, but it's still basically the same thing, you know, white and red or white gray.
There's no blue in there though currently.
And blue shows good in focus groups, apparently.
Yes. Yep.
See, that's the stuff I love. If you gotta do a body swap for toy reasons, play with it, make it fun like that. Like, give it a bit of fun, not just I advertised a new toy this week.
I want to see a backup strip in one of these issues where it's, you know, Starscream having focus groups on mundane little projects like this.
That'd be great.
Yes, Rat Trap with a little stack of signs. So do you prefer this one? Or do you prefer this?
I mean, I know it would never work as like a full issue. I would just love to see a day in the life of Starscream when nothing's going on.
Yes.
Like, there's no emergency or anything. It's just, here's what Starscream does on a typical day on Cybertron.
Mm-hmm. There is no Spotlight Starscream yet.
Oh, that would be so great.
Yes, it would.
So, even with the Blackjack thing aside, I realized that, you know, setting aside any needs of promoting the toys, using the Stunticons was actually really smart for Starscream, because, like, they're already established as combiners in IDW. They weren't really that functional in the first place, but it doesn't matter because, you know, Menasor is a thing that exists. If they discover Menasor, it's not going to raise suspicions like if, you know, they'd brought together Combaticons around Swindle. You know, there's no reason to suspect anybody doing something new. This is just this established group going off and causing trouble because, hey, they're Decepticon criminals, essentially.
That's a very good point, yeah.
It's a really happy coincidence, I think, that things could line up that way. You know, that Menasor was one of the first combiner teams out, so it's going to be one of the first introduced in the crossover.
And that's probably also why they brought Swindle in, because people know that Swindle's the one that made them into Menasor in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And, whenever, you know, this gets out and people, start asking questions, Starscream knows that he can just buy Swindle's silence.
Right, and later on, when Starscream's troopers grab Swindle in an alley somewhere, you know, they have special orders for him. It's not to kill Swindle, it's to make sure he gets back through the portal unnoticed so he can be set up as the fall guy when everything hits the wall.
Mm-hmm. And also, using Swindle, that means the Stunicons themselves can't point the finger back to Starscream because they don't know where Swindle got the Enigma.
Right. Starscream is Starscream. He's very smart about this, and he's kept himself isolated. Nobody's going to believe Swindle if he points at Starscream.
Yeah.
Yeah, I it was structured really well for the story, how all this is starting out. I'm actually kind of impressed by that. I'm impressed by the plotting of it, if not necessarily the individual issue execution so far. So, the fight scenes. When we finally got down to it, did anybody else notice that some of it was kind of choppy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing that really brought it to my attention was Chromia in Menasor's hand, where there
was
no...
That's exactly what I was going to point to.
Yeah. It just, you know, there's no sign of her even being close, aside from jumping away from that one punch, but that's not really an opportunity to be grabbed.
Yeah, she was right beside Ironhide. They were both running away, and then there's a panel in between that and her being in Menasor's hand.
Yeah, it doesn't follow.
Yeah.
Like, You know, I wonder if the fight scene didn't have to be cut down because it was taking up too much page space and it couldn't be reworked to flow better, or... The other thing is, if there had been, like, a page between the punch to the ground and Chromia being in Menasor's hand, you could accept that, okay, some time has moved while we were looking at something else, and that's she is right now, but it's like...
But there was just one panel.
Right, one panel to another, and, yeah, it doesn't follow. And, like, that's probably the most glaring example, but it kind... When you look for that, you can kind of see through the rest of it where it's still happening.
Mm-hmm.
The way
Menasor speaks in sentence fragments almost makes it seem more cut up, too. You're like, wait, did he start that sentence? Did I miss that? But, you know, just feels choppy all the way through.
Well, yeah.
Yes, but then Superion talks like The Rock, so.
Oh, new mental voice for him. Thank you.
There's another thing about the fight scenes between Superion and Menasor is that in the close-ups, they both have the appropriate amount of, you know, mass and weight, and they look very impressive, but in the long shots, they look very lean.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's not bad. It's just kind of odd compared to some of the depictions we've gotten on the cover of, you know, how bulky these guys are, and compared to the toys themselves.
And, you know, for as much as we like Sarah Stone's art style, that's one of the drawbacks of it, too, because full-body characters just tend to look like that when she draws them. You know, when it's things like the Menasor shot at the start of the issue, or in the first few pages, you know, it's structured to make Menasor look big because of the perspective, but if it's Superion and Menasor as full figures in frame fighting, it gets treated more like just a regular figure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there should have been more stuff for, like, scale in the foreground or background or something.
Like, I thought in a way the absence of surroundings kind of worked to, like, they're isolated enough because of their size that you don't see, like, the small stuff around them in these shots. Plus, it's dark and there's, you know, smoke and stuff rising up to obscure it more. Like, I could kind of get the stylistic choice in that. But, yeah, I mean, some more sense of scale would have helped it. The other thing, too, is, aside from the scale issues, the fight itself wasn't super clear. So there's Superion's torso trick, where he opens up his chest to let Menasor's arm pass through, and then partly closes it to hold him in place.
I completely missed that the first time through.
Me too.
I missed that the first three or four times through, unfortunately.
Yeah, I wouldn't have noticed it at all if I hadn't read the show notes.
Well, and it wasn't until I was going through it again earlier today to actually get, like, the discussion points put together that I noticed the second part of it, where it actually does hold him in place. It's not just absorbing the blow by letting it pass through. So, like, it's a really good idea. I like the concept, the tactics behind that. I wish it would have been clearer in the art so you could see that when you're reading it for the first time.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, like, an effect there, but I think it could have been a little bit more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
I would also like to point out how ineffective Power Glide is as a gun.
Yes.
Well, I mean, he's a good, like, stun gun.
Yeah.
Even at point blank range, you would think that shot would do a lot worse. I mean, you know, Menasor gets right back up.
But I love the expression on his face when he's got Power Glide to his head.
Yes.
And besides, it is still Power Glide. I mean, he can't be that effective.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that stuff aside, you know, the art. I mean, it's still Sarah Stone art. It's still good in a lot of places. I love Swindle's facial expressions all through this.
Oh, yeah. It is so nice to have her back.
I love everything about Swindle in this comic. I want to see more.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, compare this to Remendelli doing Swindle last time. And Swindle is, like, 500% more expressive.
And also, just, you know, compared to Remendelli in general, it is so nice not to have, you know, Rorschach tests with vaguely robot-y shapes in them. You can make out shapes and characters and art and expressions. It's like they're real drawings here.
You know, one thing I really like here, which I think gave Sarah Stone a chance to show off the digital painting she does is in the first page, the establishing shot of Kaminus.
Yes.
Which apparently orbits a gas giant, which is something we'd never actually known about it before that I can remember. So, you know, we got the pretty gas giant, we got a nice star field, the little white dwarf star in the distance. It was a really nice little panel.
Yeah.
That easily could have supported, like, a full page if there had been room for it. Obviously, there wasn't, because some of these panels were really tight and crammed in there, and, you know, the way the fight went, it looked like they had to maybe cut stuff out anyway. That might be, like, the one thing the issue kind of did wrong. It tried to do too much, and it didn't have enough space to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the coloring in this, like you said, it's not Rorschach test. It's bright, it's smooth, and it looks really nice. But, Mark, you thought it looked a little different?
I just had the thought that it felt a bit less like a watercolor painting, which was a kind of a feeling I got from the Windblade series. Here, everything feels a little more, I don't know, for lack of a better word, traditional. It's not bad by any means, and maybe it helps it gel a bit with other artist styles, but something just felt a little bit different. It could just be her style evolving, but you could notice a difference. Like, if you show me a page of this versus a page of the original four-parter, I could probably tell them apart.
I was thinking, too, this seems reasonably consistent with Robots in Disguise 34. I think it's 34. I always get that number wrong, though. When Wheeljack came back and she did the interiors for that, like, the coloring in this felt similar to that to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I put in the notes, I feel like this is just an evolution of her style to not just, you know, because styles evolve, but also just to cope with the realities of doing a monthly comic, because this has to be a little bit easier to put together with the line art surviving to the final step. That has to help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, like, judging by the solicitations, the next issue of Windblade may have Remendelli doing the interiors on it, and then issue 4 solicitation also lists a different interior artist, so even with this in mind, we may only get Sarah Stone, like, every other issue or something.
That is a shame.
Very much so.
On the other hand, I like her style enough that if it means, you know, having an alternating artist thing, I'll take that to get more of her on interiors in general.
Absolutely.
And likewise, if it means she does not burn out on doing this kind of work, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, exactly. So, Mark, you raised a point in the notes about the formal speech used between Lady of Flame, or the Mistress of Flame, Windblade, and Optimus. Like, for me, I think it was appropriate to the setting, because the Mistress of Flame is their spiritual leader, basically, according to what's been revealed in the interviews so far. And, like, I can understand that character speaking that way, and it's like there being a certain protocol to addressing her.
Yeah, and I think it works good for now, and I imagine, you know, as time goes on, we won't be seeing it all the time, forever, you know, speaking in that I hear and I do sort of way. I think it's an interesting touch, and it definitely shows that Kaminus is a deeply religious society, which is something I want to learn more about. You know, we've heard there's only one religion. You know, Windblade talks about, you know, like they're saying, look, they'll think you're a god, and she says it almost without question. It's very interesting to see that compared to the rest of, which generally tends to be fairly non-religious, although you do get hints here and there, like obviously, you know, Cyclonus or Starsaber, but at least in like John Barber's work, there's not a whole lot of religion, or at least outward religion.
I think it's partly that the religious aspect of, like, the main group of Transformers we tend to see, it's more of a, I don't want to say a casual thing, but it doesn't, like, dominate their lives. Like, through offhand references, we know, like, Swerve is a follower of Adaptus because of things he said, and there's, you know, other stuff since that's been introduced in the current IDW era. Like, I think for them, it's just more a matter of course. It's something they talk about less formally, less rigidly, just because, well, this is just the way it is, and this is how we live, and whereas Kaminus seems to be more structured with what they do.
Yeah, I always kind of took it as that the people, the members, particularly in More Than Meets the Eye, of the cast that have been most directly, I want to say, involved in the war itself, there is not a lot of, you know, ritual or daily expression of their faith left in their lives because they have not had time for it because 4 million years of war. Mm-hmm. You know, Cyclonus has his own deal and he comes from a different place. Drift basically turned to religion to deal with the things he did during the war. And so they are basically the two most outwardly religious or even, I guess I want to say, ritualized characters in most of the mainstream plot that we've seen. I think basically the people of Kamenus have had time to stay with their rituals and their religious practices because they haven't spent all this time trying to kill each other.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And there's also Tailgate, who skipped the war entirely, but was effectively a newborn, so he never had the chance to adopt any belief system.
Yes.
Which is why he's basically completely away from all of that, where otherwise someone who skipped over the war from that time period probably would be more like Cyclonus or Drift or even the Kamians in how they view it.
Or like the Circle of Light.
So Mark also brought up an interesting point. Is Windblade devout?
I don't think so.
She pretty much hints in talking to Optimus Prime that she is not, that she, Chromia and Nautica were not really, you know, firm believers. She says
they were chosen for their skills, not their beliefs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like, it seems to be like, you know, the teachings they've received on Kamenus through their lives make them understand the principles that would make the others view Optimus as a religious figure himself, but they don't necessarily follow that teaching on their own. Like, Nautica for sure seems not to, because she's so much the scientist type, and I don't think she doesn't show any sign of going in for that at all.
No, I think we were chosen for our skills, not our beliefs, is probably the nice way of saying, you know, we have dealt with this society for all our lives and we don't entirely fit in, so this is why we volunteered to be the first three to get off the planet.
Well, and Chromia is the type too, like, she seems like she would be helped by it in a way. Like, just, you know,
I can see that.
If there's a peace to be found in their belief system, Chromia is so angry and hostile most of the time, it seems like that's something she could benefit from. And if she had that, she probably would not be as extreme as she's been presented so far.
It could also be that having those beliefs, she went to protect Windblade and really isn't comfortable in the outer universe that does not share them, which is why she's been another reason she's been so intent on getting home and staying there.
You know, that would be an interesting thing to explore also if that ended up being the case. You know, hopefully if something like that were to be so, there would be room to see that fleshed out a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, like, one thing I really liked in this issue, ultimately, is that we got a pretty solid dose of what the culture is on this colony. Like, we got the Cliff Notes version, obviously, but we still got a lot out of this.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of meat to explore with this, and hopefully, since the Combiner Wars is looking like it's mostly going to focus on what's happening on Kamenus, we'll get a chance to see more of that in effect.
Yeah.
So, guys, do you have any other thoughts on this issue? Oh, we should probably talk about the covers briefly. So, there was the set of shop-exclusive covers with Devastator smashing the shops. I don't know about you guys, none of these really grabbed me like the Superion covers did.
Yeah,
they seem pretty standard, yeah.
It's all variations on Rubble.
Yeah.
I kind of liked them for being a bit more dynamic than the Superior ones, but it's still kind of standard fare.
Yeah.
Also kind of entertaining. If I went to one of those shops or owned one of those shops, I'd probably be more entertained by it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Just
watching someone draw my business get smashed, but... But yeah, I think to fully appreciate that, you would have to go to these stores yourself.
I think so. And, like, if I had access to St. Mark Comics, I would definitely buy their Superion cover. Because, like, aside from anything else, I think it's a really neat-looking piece of art.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, that grabbed me even without having a connection to the store, but all the smashed ones, yeah, it's probably entertaining if you're familiar with these personally, but just to look at them as covers, it's kind of, they all kind of run together.
Yeah.
So, for the major covers, we have another Casey Collar and Joanna LaFuente collaboration, which is basically the parallel to Transformers 39's cover. And, you know, it looks just as good. It has the really clean line art, the nice coloring, and the awareness of lighting. I think I would like a little more thematic variation and not just basically have a clone of the covers clone each other, but with the characters substituted, essentially.
Yeah.
It still looks really nice, though.
It does. It really does.
Like, I can't even complain about that.
No. I mean, that was the only thing I could complain about, is just that, well, could it be something other than just the characters being substituted in effect?
Yeah.
But both are still really nice to look at individually.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, there's the Olivia Ramondelli subscriber cover. I'm so sorry, subscribers.
Yes.
Next.
This one actually, just if I can just stick with it for a second, feels the worst. Everyone feels like they're cardboard cutouts. Their edges feel weird to me for some reason. They're also sharp. They look like they're paper glued together like old South Park or something. The edges bother me.
I think the reason for that is also one thing I will give Ramondelli credit for change, is that he seems to have excluded Windblade and Starscream from the wash that is over Menasor, making him look dark and muddy, which them both being bright red kind of helps them pop. So, you know, that I'd like to see him actually do that more often and actually have elements of panels that are recognizable. For a change?
I think part of that, too, is probably Menasor is filtered to make him more part of the background.
Yeah, to give a sense of scale by making him look as far away as possible.
Right, and, you know, in the absence of actual scale.
Yeah.
So the retailer incentive cover is, again, by Sarah Petrie DeRocher, assuming I'm pronouncing that name correctly. And it's the counter to... Transformers 39's retailer incentive cover, which it's similar in theme. It's Windblade standing in Superion's hand. Got the nice little extra touch of a fist bump between them, which that's got to be a dubious proposition.
Yes, especially when Windblade's staring right into Superion's knuckle blaster.
Yeah.
Considering Superion never used the knuckle guns at all in that fight, maybe they just don't work.
Could be.
They're not loaded.
They're probably still more effective than Power Glide, though.
I like this cover a lot better than the Menasor equivalent. The lines look a little bit cleaner, and the coloring just kind of pops more on it because there's more bright colors.
Yeah.
The one thing I didn't really like about it, though, is the interpretation of Windblade's design. Like, it's not bad, it's just a little bit outside the field I tend to like.
Yeah, it goes a little bit smoother than most.
Yeah, that's it. Versions of Windblade. It's too smooth looking. Thank you. I could not put my finger on exactly what was wrong, just that it was. But the parts of Superion you can see look so good, and I love the coloring on this too.
Yeah.
This is another one of those artists where, like, interiors would never work on any kind of timetable because this has to take forever to do right.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, anybody have any final thoughts on the issue before we wrap up?
I'm just super happy to see Afterburner exist in fiction. He was one of my first guys. I'm a G2 guy. Oh, that makes me happy.
Or is he Snipe?
Well, he's Snipe if he's dead. He's Afterburner if Afterburner is still alive.
Okay, dude, he got stomped on. He's dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I saw a couple of Predators in Starscream Secret Police, too, whenever they flew through the... or flew through the space bridge.
Were they part of the group, or were they, like, you know, they sent the Kamian flyers to fight Menasor also, like, you could see
it looked
them.
Like they were flying out of the space bridge, though.
Okay, so it's probably just a case of, you know, here's
yeah,
a bunch
when,
of models.
When Swindle was hiding from the secret police, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I probably just, you know, here's a bunch of models to use and,
yeah.
you know, mix and match.
Yeah.
Make sure they're colored consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
But yeah, basically the only thing I can say is that what I said at the beginning, it is nice to have it. I like this issue a lot more than the first issue, not just because of art, but because of where the story seems to be going, because Starscream is more interesting, and, you know, if the rest of it is more like this, I will be happy.
Yeah, it's definitely a good start. I'm just afraid when we go back to Transformers number 40 next time, it's going to be more like Transformers 39.
Yeah. And then yeah. there's the possibility that Windblade number 2 will be more like Transformers 39, so...
Oh.
Especially yeah. with the interior art.
Yeah.
Crap.
But the writing matters too, so maybe it'll be okay-ish.
Yeah, I'm just
well, the writing matters too, but the art can be very distracting.
Yeah, yeah. We've seen, you know, not to brag on Augustin Padilla too much, which I've done in the past, but we've seen what Marigold Scott's writing looks like in a comic with an artist who is maybe not up to the kind of expressive characters that she needs. And I'm not 100% confident as to how good the final product of that would be.
Oh, I've tried to forget about that.
Haven't we all?
Okay, so I think that'll do it for us this week. Thank you guys for joining me to talk about the issue, and thank you all for listening. We will be back next time with part 3 of Combiner Wars here on Fanboys vs. Transformers.
Need to catch up? Visit tfradio.net/Amazon and start shopping for collected volumes of all the Transformers titles. For comic book news, reviews, and more, visit tformers.com. Fanboy vs. Transformers is a Radio Free Cybertron production.